Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is Podcast 67 for Tuesday, September 14th, 2010. I'll be one of your hosts this week. My name is David O'Brien, and with me are...
Dominic Rabe.
And Ben Snickoff.
As usual, we will be covering three stories for you this week, including the Werner v. Autodesk decision. HP is also suing Mark Hurd for trade secret violations. And finally, Apple has eased their rules for developers in the App Store. So, diving right into it, our first story is all about the first sale doctrine, EULAs, and copyright violations, at least of a sort. Just the other day, the Ninth Circuit issued its opinion in Werner v. Autodesk, and this is a case that's actually been kicking around in the district courts, actually up in Washington, the Pacific Northwest Washington, that is, and it's all about whether a person can sell used software on eBay. In the case, there was a guy named Werner, and he bought several copies of AutoCAD, which is a computer-assisted design type of a software, which was produced by a company named Autodesk. And he bought the software from a couple different places, but they were all used. It definitely includes a garage sale and perhaps even an office sale. And when he bought them, they came in, I think, their original boxes. They also had the activation codes that you would need after you install the software. But Werner didn't install any of the software on his computer. Instead, he decided to go and list them on eBay for sale. He was able to actually sell a bunch of them. But in the process of selling these copies, Autodesk was a little bit upset, and they sent several takedown notices to Werner. And each time Werner received a takedown notice, he actually issued a counter notice, and so he was able to get the listing back up. But at some point, eBay started to get a little concerned about the number of takedown notices that Werner was receiving, and eventually tried to cancel his account or deactivate it as a repeat infringer, just based on the number of takedown notices received. And Werner was able to get his account back up, but decided it was a good idea not to list any more copies of AutoCAD for sale on eBay. And instead, he wrote Autodesk and argued that he did, in fact, have the right to sell these copies of software because of the first sale doctrine, which is a codified exception in copyright law, which sort of limits the ability of a copyright holder to collect royalties past the first sale of a hard copy of an item. So the best example that people use all the time are used bookstores. The first time that a book is actually sold, the copyright holder, or in some cases that might actually be the publisher, has the right to collect a royalty over the first sale of that book. But after the book has been sold that first time, the owner of the copy can then go and sell it or give it or rent it to other people and not have to pay any royalties back to the original copyright holder. So Werner tried to argue that and also said, I'm not subject to the license agreement that applies to this software either because I never agreed to it. I didn't install it on my computer, so I never had to click an I agree, and I wasn't the original person who bought it, so the argument that I tore off the shrink wrap and was aware of all these things when I originally bought it also doesn't apply. And Autodesk disagreed, and to remedy the situation, Werner actually sued Autodesk for what we call a declaratory judgment, which is sort of one of these funny, I'm going to sue you to prevent a lawsuit. And he asked a judge, basically, in the process to declare that he wasn't infringing any copyrights by selling them on eBay, and also counterclaims copyright misuse. Now, the district court eventually said that, yes, the first sale doctrine is in your favor here, Werner, and it's okay to sell this. Autodesk eventually appealed. It got up to the Ninth Circuit, which brings us right up to speed. And this week, the Ninth Circuit actually reversed course of the district court. There was a little bit of a quirk, though, so the district court, because they said that the first sale doctrine was, in fact, a defense in this case, they never reached the issue of copyright misuse. So that wasn't decided by the district court, whether or not there was any copyright misuse in this instance, or by the Ninth Circuit, and this was just about the first sale doctrine for the most part. But this might have huge implications, though, for licensing software in the future, and in fact, it makes those agreements which apply to software much more robust. So, turning this over to the panel, do you guys have any initial thoughts on this story? Was this a surprising opinion? Does this settle some law that we thought would go this way for a long time?
Go ahead, Ben.
I don't think it's that surprising. I would have liked it to come out the other way, but the general feeling among copyright specialists was that the district court got it wrong in finding that the first sale doctrine applied. Dominic, what were you thinking?
I was going to say that it's not surprising, but it felt like the Ninth Circuit kind of regretfully issued the opinion in that they were kind of bound by precedent and couldn't rule the way that you mentioned that you would hope they would have come out.
No, that's interesting because I didn't actually get that sense at all after I read the opinion. I felt like there, at least in the Ninth Circuit, there was a lot of decisions out there which could have led the circuit court to reach the exact opposite opinion. But it seemed like towards the end of the opinion, and this wasn't a terribly long opinion, it was about 35 pages, and we'll of course link to it in the show notes. The court was noted, and there were a lot of amicus briefs which were filed with this, with other interested groups, including the EFF, and including I think the Librarians Association of America or some similar group, and they were raising all these concerns, like these licenses are really restrictive, and you know it. They shouldn't. It shouldn't be the case that we just accept them to always be licenses, and that you're not actually transferred ownership of a piece of software when you purchase it in a store. And still, the court came down this way and sort of was able to sort of carve out little exceptions to things that they have said in the past. It seems like they qualified a lot of their precedent that had actually been made in the same circuit.
Can you give an example of what you're talking about? Because I didn't. I'm more with Dominic in that I feel like they felt like they were bound by precedent, and that this wasn't really an extension of the first sale doctrine.
Well, there's actually a line of cases, they're called the MAI trio, in which they reached pretty much the opposite decision, at least one of them. And what this whole debate is about, and for our listeners, we should probably pan this out a little bit. There are a number of cases in the US, not just in the Ninth Circuit, which have held that even though it with a sale of software, if you attach a license agreement to it and call it a license explicitly within the agreement, that doesn't necessarily mean that this is a licensing situation where the producer of the software is in fact retaining ownership and basically renting it out to the software user. So just because you call it a duck doesn't mean that it's actually a duck. And there were a couple of cases that were in California which reached this conclusion as well. And it felt like that if the court had wanted to sort of change course on policy and actually establish some concrete rules to situations where you can where if you call something a license, it doesn't necessarily make it a license. It seems like they sort of turned away from that.
I mean, I don't necessarily disagree. They put a lot of emphasis, they being the court, on how restrictive the Autodesk license was, and they quote a bit of it saying that under the Autodesk license, you may not modify, translate, reverse engineer, decompile, disassemble the software. You may not remove any proprietary notices, labels, or mark from the software documentation. You may not use the software outside the Western Hemisphere. And these are, three of the first four in a list that went on and on and on of things that you can't do. And at some point, you have to draw the line between what's a sale of a copy of something that's copyrighted and what's a license. And the court here said, listen, when you've got so many absurdly restrictive covenants in this, then it's a license. You couldn't look at this and call this a sale under any reasonable interpretation of the contract.
As for the MAI cases, that trio, that, from what I understand, it arose because Congress, because back in the day, it was technically copyright infringement if you would install software on your computer because they were
Right.
copies being made from the disk. And so what Congress did is they amended the Copyright Act that said, oh, the owner of a copy of copyrighted software has this defense called the essential step defense that lets them install the program on their computer without committing copyright violation and run the program on their computer without committing copyright violation. The MAI cases basically involved what happens if someone doesn't own the software but is merely a licensee, and the end result was Congress went back and actually changed it to a computer owner has the right, so basically sidestepping whether or not he was an owner of the software or the licensee. I'm not entirely sure how or why you feel they're on. I mean, the court definitely treated them, but I don't see how they would hold for the opposite ruling that they made.
Well, it was mostly in the dicta that was discussed within those opinions. I think the overall policy that was kicking around in the courts at that time was that this might not be something that we want to ex a situation where we might not want to extend rights in perpetuity also. And that was a big part part of this court's decision as well. They considered, can you really have a license when the license is essentially granting rights in perpetuity? Because if you think about any other type of rental agreement or situation where somebody is authorizing somebody else to use something for a limited period of time or for certain uses but not transferring ownership, you often think that there is an end period in sight, that it's not going to continue to go on. But this license was not that way at all. It essentially created a type of relationship that was structured to go on in perpetuity.
So you're arguing basically that because it's an indefinite license, it's not really a license?
Well, yeah, that is something that other courts have also agreed with in the past.
The flip side of that is worrisome, though. If we follow your logic, then what software companies are going to do is say, you're not purchasing a license to use this software, you're purchasing a license to use this software for 2 years.
Well, yeah, that is a good point. But normally what happens in these situations, though, is rather than treating these as license agreements, they treat them as sales with restrictions. And so it doesn't necessarily invalidate the language that is also contained within the so-called EULA. We'll call it not quite a EULA because it's a contract with restrictions on it. But the ownership of the copy of software that's contained on the media that you're going to install on your computer is yours, and you own it. But it comes with the following restrictions that apply to you when you bought it. It's just you throw out the licensing part of the equation.
So if we consider it a sale, so you get the sale with restrictions, then if you violate the restrictions, you get breach of contract, but if we consider it a license, breach of the license agreement results in copyright liability.
Yes. But as part of those restrictions on use, you can also, of course, like any other contract, set up limited circumstances for use where you've retained certain copyrights, but you have to distinguish the ownership of the copyright itself from the ownership of the copy that the copyright is embodied on, the physical media. And that's where the first sale doctrine comes into play. You go back to the scenario of, I bought a book from a bookstore, the right to collect royalties has expired once I purchased it at the bookstore, and then I can go and sell and do whatever I like with the book after that and not have to worry about going back and paying the original person who wrote the book. Anyway, this is just some of the logic that was at stake in this opinion, and I've been talking, at least on my half, about one side of why we might not want license agreements to attach to software, but there are a lot of reasons why you do want them to attach to software. And part of that has to go with some of the points that you guys have raised, and that's because this allows for tiered pricing models, and the court discussed a lot of this, and there are a bunch of other reasons why we want developers to be able to take advantage of restricting uses through a license agreement while still retaining title to it. And you guys can feel free to add anything to that if you like.
I guess I'm all set. This is obviously, it's an important decision and it's kind of a complicated decision, and I imagine we're going to be trying to untangle what this means, and we'll be seeing repercussions from this in licensing agreements going forward.
Well, you know, another thing that's important to note is that now this goes, since the decision was vacated by the Ninth Circuit, it's going to go back on remand back to the district court, and they're going to hash out the copyright misuse claims, and those are still left to litigate.
Yeah, I think I agree basically with Ben. There's also a line in the opinion that I want to point out, that Congress is free, of course, to modify the first sale doctrine and the essential step defense if it deems these or other policy considerations to require a different approach. So basically the Ninth Circuit is saying, hey, there are serious contentions on both sides, but precedent makes us rule this way, but if you want to change things, Congress, go ahead.
Any last thoughts on this before we move on to the next story? David?
Nope.
And Dominic?
Also.
Okay, so our second story is an ongoing part of the Mark Hurd saga. So for those of you who missed the first part of this, in 2005, HP hired a new CEO, Mark Hurd. He took the reins of the company and led it through what was a very successful relatively successful period, at least compared to the years before he took the reins. However, one flip side of this was that apparently during this period of time, morale was very low at the company. I don't know how much this has to do with what went on. Anyway, Mark Hurd got into a bit of a tiff over, shall we say, how he billed certain things to the company, what he claimed as expenses. And he was fired by the board of directors of HP. And shortly after he was fired, Oracle picked him up and brought him onto their team. Now, HP has filed suit against Mark Hurd and DOES number 1 through 25, alleging that Mark Hurd is committed breach of contract with HP and that he is either in the process or likely to reveal trade secrets. And basically, what they're trying to do is prevent Oracle from hiring or prevent him from working from Oracle. Now, what's interesting is non-compete clauses in contracts are not enforceable in California. So, what happens in a lot of states is that if you go to work for some technology company, or it really could be any type of company, but you see it a lot in high-tech industry, your contract will include what's called a non-compete clause. And these can vary, but essentially they'll say something along the lines of something along the lines of after you finish working for this company for a period of 2 years, you cannot work for any company that works in a competing field in a radius of 50 miles, or you just cannot work for a direct competitor of us. And these vary based on basically what state they're in, because different states will treat them differently. Some states will say that, if it's within a 100-mile radius that you can't work, then it's invalid, but that's really a side point. Anyway, California does not enforce these because they think they're anti-competitive, they're against state policy. However, there are ways to get around that, and that's what we're seeing in this lawsuit. Essentially, when Mark Hurd started to work for HP, he signed a contract, and that contract contained certain provisions with regard to how he had to treat confidential information. For example, he was supposed to inform HP if he ended up working for a competitor, he had to inform them within a certain amount of time, and all of these things kind of pile up into HP's claim. So, Dominic, any initial thoughts on this story? Should he be concerned about this? Is this really just an end run around a non-compete?
Well, I'm not familiar with what happens in California with the non-compete basically being invalid as just thrown out the window, but the trade secret stuff is pretty relevant. I can see how an executive with lots of access to HP would be very attractive to Oracle, considering they compete with HP in a lot of areas. And he couldn't disclose those trade secrets according to the contract he made with HP, but trade secret litigation, it can get really messy.
David, any initial thoughts on this story from your point of view?
Well, it's really fascinating because of the restriction on non-compete clauses in California that's actually codified within I don't know the statute citation off the top of my head, but it is in fact codified and it's recognized as one of the broadest restriction on non-compete clauses in the country.
Yeah, so to clarify, what HP is actually looking for is an order requiring Mark Hurd to provide HP with sufficient notification of his new employer and provide them with further information so they can get some sort of trade secret agreement and protections in place. And in the meantime, they're looking for a preliminary injunction to keep him, Mark Hurd, from working with Oracle until they can resolve this litigation. They're also asking for compensatory damages and it looks like attorney's fees and costs. And those may be provided for under California law, I'm not sure. Otherwise, it's just a kind of pro forma thing that they'd put them in there, put a request for fees and costs in. I think this is interesting in that if there's. David said that it was the fact that trade secrets are not enforceable, I'm sorry, not trade secrets, the fact that non-competes are unenforceable is codified. It'd be interesting to see whether or not a court here, while they do treat trade secrets and misappropriation of trade secrets very secret, very very severely, they treat it very seriously in California. Would they? To me, at least, this seems like a pretty bald-faced attempt to keep, their ousted CEO from working with somebody else. Would the court kind of impute the legislature's intent from the non-compete statute to say, we're going to let him continue to work for Oracle and have him know that if trade secrets do leak out, if he does disclose trade secrets to Oracle, then there will be severe repercussions?
Well, here, actually, I did actually just find the citation. So this is part of the California Business and Professionals Code, and this is section 16600. That's a huge number. Anyway, it reads, and it's just one sentence, except as provided in this chapter, every contract by which anyone is restrained from engaging in a lawful profession, trade, or business of any kind is to that extent void. So there is some really interesting interplay here, I think, with what you're talking about, Ben, and I wonder, and none of us are California attorneys, and as far as I know, none of us really ever practice in California, and we're really not that familiar with California law and the case law, but I wonder if there's some sort of tenable argument that Heard could make in this case that the provisions within his employment agreement, which he had with HP, which includes a confidential information section, which sort of defines it very broadly, first of all, and it says that I'm not going to disclose any confidential information to any competitors or anybody outside the company. I wonder if there's some argument that you could say that this is really akin to a non-compete clause in an agreement, and it's in fact somehow or in some way not enforceable. And I don't know that they would ever void the entire thing. There's no way. I mean, trade secret law is pretty robust, but I wonder if like they, if HP would be unsuccessful in preventing him from taking a position at Oracle, but they might be successful for certain things, and if they could be granted an injunction of some kind to prevent him from disclosing certain things. All those things I'm not sure about, but they're really interesting questions.
Yeah, I was actually. You go, Dominic. I took the first comment lap.
I'm really not sure what HP is doing with this lawsuit, because apparently their severance agreement that they signed with Heard when they fired him doesn't include a non-compete provision, probably because California wouldn't honor it even if it was there. And look, they fired the guy for cause because apparently he filed false expense reports. They gave him $35 million in severance pay, and now they're suing him. Interestingly, they paid all that severance pay immediately, so it's not like overtime or anything. They just gave him a chunk of money right away. I guess I'm really unclear what they're hoping to achieve by paying him $35 million after firing him and then filing a lawsuit against him. It just doesn't make sense to me.
Clearly, they don't want him to take the position at Oracle because they're, and as you noted in the beginning, they're competitors, and he probably does have a lot of information, that internal information from HP, which would be really valuable from a strategic standpoint over at Oracle.
Right. But he's bound by the agreement to not disclose those trade secrets and confidential information. And
Oh, see, I
California
think there's
doesn't recognize what's called the inevitable disclosure doctrine, which most people would probably say, hey, if you know it, you're probably going to disclose it. California doesn't recognize the inevitable disclosure doctrine, which means that technically speaking, in California, he could just not disclose HP's trade secrets. And it really seems, I guess it seems almost premature for HP to go right after him right away because he hasn't disclosed anything.
But how are you going to know from HP's standpoint at what point he does disclose those trade secrets?
That's true, you don't know. That's why trade secret lawsuits can get really messy.
Yeah, I'm with Dominic that the proper remedy would be to, write him a stern letter that says, listen, we accept that you have a new job and, understand that there's a risk of you accidentally or intentionally divulging trade secrets while you're at this new job. Please be very careful not to do that and understand that we will go after you for the full measure of damages if you do. Other than viewing this and even those contract terms as an essential non-compete, I don't know, we don't have the full extent of the contract in here, but it's very possible that Mark Hurd, as David suggested, could go to the court and say, listen, look at these contract terms. There's no way that I could possibly comply with them and take a job in a competing field. And, these contract terms taken as a whole, whether they are meant to protect trade secrets, essentially form a non-compete. And if that's the case, I, as a judge, if I were a judge, I would be amenable to and not granting the preliminary injunction, at least to until we can get, the contract sorted out in some better way.
Does anyone know what's ha it, have they filed a motion for preliminary injunction or anything yet?
Yes.
Yeah, the civil complaint asked for a preliminary injunction. I imagine, in addition to the complaint, they filed a memorandum in support of the motion or, prayer for a preliminary injunction.
So, this is actually a well debated issue, I think, in California. I know that I've seen a number of at least law journal articles written by scholars and academics about this issue of if you have a non-enforceable non-compete clause and you also have trade secret law that's enforceable within the state, those two areas overlap a lot, and so you're bound to have problems where the spirit of the restriction on non-competes just simply couldn't be enforced if you're going to have full protection for certain types of trade secrets. And interestingly, I think I came across a line of cases. I don't know what the actual result of them was, but they have something called the trade secret exception. And I'm not sure if this is still enforceable in California, but it used to be that you could have a non-compete clause, at least to some extent, that was enforceable to the extent that it applied to trade secrets. And it was a very narrow exception, I believe, but I know it was challenged a number of times, and at some point recently, in the last 3 years, went up before the California Supreme Court. I don't know what the results of that case were, though.
Yeah, that's interesting. If that were still in place, I would have expected HP to have mentioned it in their pleadings, but I may have glossed over
Well,
it in my
you don't
reading of it
normally
or.
cite case law though in a complaint.
It happens sometimes. I'm with David that, it doesn't happen a lot. You usually have citations to statute. Every now and then people throw in a citation to a law. I guess it varies from attorney to attorney, from attorney to attorney. Any last thoughts on this, David?
Nope.
Dominic.
All set.
Okay, Dominic, how about you take it away with the last story?
Sure, our last story is that Apple has actually released App Store review guidelines as well as updating the developer license agreement for developing an iOS. The reason we're covering this story is over the past couple months, we've covered a lot of app rejection stories, and it's interesting because Apple has actually given up a lot of ground and come forth and actually explained how they approve apps into the App Store. So first, I want to talk about the changes to the developer agreement because this is pretty significant. The first big change is that third-party developer tools and languages are no longer banned. That section is just gone. There is no longer any ban on having Adobe, for example, run their little Flash converter, and you build something in Flash, then run Adobe's Flash converter and put it on the iPhone. Adobe had actually stopped developing that feature in CS5 and now announced that because Apple changed the terms of the developer agreement, they'll be resuming developing that. Similarly, they've updated their text on interpreters slightly to clarify it. The biggest thing, though, is probably going to be with regard to Google. Effectively, their previous developer agreement banned AdMob. Basically, it said that any sort of ad service that collects analytical data, analytics data, can't be used. Now it says you can, as long as it has user consent, or to serve advertising. You can collect user data with consent, and then only if it's to provide a service or function, or for advertising. So those are two really big things. Both Adobe and Google were really concerned about those two provisions, and both those provisions are pretty much eviscerated right now. And finally, the App Store review guidelines are written probably partly by Steve Jobs. One sentence does say, "We don't need any more fart apps." But basically, it's pretty straightforward and short, and they want to maintain a high quality apps and make sure that stuff is pretty well done.
So professional fart apps are still okay.
Professional fart apps are potentially okay. Interestingly, they do say that if there's no offensive or mean-spirited commentary unless you're a professional political satirist or humorist. Why they distinguish between professionals and us amateurs is beyond me. But thoughts, esteemed panel?
So I have a question. What exactly does this mean for Adobe? And we've heard a lot in the past about how tortured the relationship is between Adobe and Steve Jobs / Apple.
For one, I don't think that it's a tortured relationship outside of the little flash tiff that went on. And given the results of, at least the initial results of how Flash is faring on Froyo Android 2.2, I don't think Adobe is going to bring up that fact anytime in the near future. And as for, you know, the other part of this tiff, which was when Apple amended the iOS guidelines to prohibit third-party app compilation, that's gone. So now Adobe can start developing and have said that they are going to start redeveloping their Flash to iPhone compiler that will take Flash content made in Adobe Flash and compile it to run on iPhones. I think specifically the goal for that is games.
So this is not a legal question, but what is the benefit that Apple gets by easing the restrictions on submitting applications through the App Store?
And no more news stories about people complaining that they got rejected, or at least fewer.
Okay. But even those, I mean, those seem to be sort of taken care of on their own. I mean, we heard a lot about those when the App Store came out, but the App Store now is a bit more mature, and you know, it's been a long time since I heard a story that was covered more than once or in one day about a developer who had an application that was denied, surprisingly.
Yeah. I think a large part of the complaints were that there was no review guidelines. It was all a very black box process. You submit your app, you pray, and, oh, it's rejected. That sucks. Now, at least, there's guidelines. Even though the guidelines have theoretically been enforced all this time, and the guidelines do say that they're a living document, it's a little more reassuring to people to have the fact that, oh, look, there's this list of stuff. Okay.
And one of the things in the guidelines do say that this is a living document, and every day we get applications that, you know, force us to reconsider whether or not we'll accept that or a similar application. So, you know, you've got these guidelines, I forget how many there are. There are a lot of them, and, you know, theoretically, if you go down and check off every one of them, your app should get in. But Apple says, you know, there's a chance that if you make something that we didn't think of, we're going to reject it, and then, you know, we'll add another thing to these guidelines.
Did anyone ever have any question if there was ever going to be like an antitrust probe from the Department of Justice, or any antitrust allegations from, say, the development community, in light of the former rules?
I know that, I think it was the FTC said they started an investigation. So there have been a couple of investigations that have allegedly been started. There was Adobe asked the FTC to investigate Apple over the whole Flash kerfluffle, and I don't know what the current status of that would be in light of the changes that Apple's made now, allowing for Flash development through, you know, compiled Flash development, as opposed to, I don't think Apple will allow non-compiled Flash or like a Flash plugin. I'm sure that's still off the table, but you know, there was that, and there was also, I think, the FTC was thinking of investigating, or actually was investigating, Apple's the last change that we also mentioned about whether or not third-party ad services can have access to information on the iPhone. I know they cited iAds as a reason to approve Google's purchase of AdMob, but I don't know if they were investigating Apple's blocking or supposed blocking of Google and AdMob from the iPhone. And to the best of my knowledge, that blocking never actually happened. I remember a statement from Google after iPhone 4.0 launched that said they were still getting data from the applications, that it was not being blocked despite the fact that the developer guidelines said that it would be.
Yeah, I don't think any significant antitrust action would really have much chance because part of the magic of antitrust is you have to define your market, and I'd really be hard pressed to define the market as anything other than smart mobile devices, so to speak. You wouldn't be able to restrict the market just to the iPhone because that just isn't the market. I mean, Android is a competitor, BlackBerry is a competitor.
So, I'll play devil's advocate here. How is that different then, that market definition that you were just talking about, from, say, Windows back in the day when they were investigated by the Department of Justice, and eventually, they also found themselves in a lot of antitrust trouble when they tried to shut down various portions of the Windows platform for, internet browsers.
Windows, though, that had the personal computer, and well, internet browsers was a separate issue. But first, we'll talk about back in the day, Windows had maybe 95% of market share of personal computers. That is significant. I mean, Apple had that little slice, and then Linuxes, which were very, very nascent at the time, were almost insubstantial. So, and if you define the market as personal computer operating systems, Windows basically had the vast lion's share of it. Later on, with the browser market, there, I think that was more a tying issue in that they were saying that Internet Explorer is not dividable from the operating system, so they're trying to leverage their superior position in the operating system market to basically provide users with the web browser so that they didn't have to go get Netscape. The European Commission actually had serious issues with that, and I think they forced them to separate the browser and the operating system. But basically, the antitrust issue there was they were using their de facto monopoly in one market to try to acquire a market power in another market.
And so there's
There's
no analog
actually
there.
A really interesting talk about the Microsoft antitrust case, and I'm going to plug this on behalf of David. The Berkman Center has Radio Berkman podcast, and they did a talk with Jonathan, and I'm going to butcher his name, Zittrain, and
Zittrain.
Larry Lessig, Zittrain, and Larry Lessig about the Microsoft antitrust case. It was a very interesting conversation. I would suggest everyone go over to the Berkman Center website and find that if they can.
And as a matter of fact, I was present for most of that discussion, although I had to leave halfway through it.
Ah, so you were one of the what do they call them? Burke turns? Berkman turns?
No, well, those are all the interns that we had over at the center. There are quite a few of them, 40. But yeah, I was present there, listening to the talk. And hopefully, it looks like they're going to do a series between Zittrain and Lessig also. So hopefully we'll see more investigation of some of these issues. But they raised some interesting questions about platforms, perhaps like Facebook and the iPhone, and how you might consider them sort of closed environments that might be markets that there is potentially antitrust concerns in. The problem that they point out is that you agree to a contract as a developer when you submit your application, and as part of that, you agree to abide by the Apple terms. And part of that says, like, we're going to look at your submission, and we're going to accept some of them and deny some of them, and it's going to be on our own terms. And because of that, they've sort of foreclosed the option of, or the ability for developers to argue that, they weren't aware of that Apple is going to restrict a lot of people with their submissions as they submit them. So we'll see what happens as this sort of plays out. But I'm always curious when I see large changes like this in policy, that and as it deals with restrictions for developers and what the actual purpose of it is. I'm always curious what's being gained and what's being lost. So I don't know if this was really an antitrust thing, and I'm don't really suspect it was. There hasn't been any serious thought that a government agency would actually investigate Apple for something like this. But some developers do sort of complain a lot that they can't get their applications in, and competitors like Google also seem to have issues as well.
Yeah, Google did mention that according to the App Store guidelines now, Google Voice should be approved, which has been in limbo for a year, maybe a little more than a year.
Yeah.
But we'll see if that actually happens.
Anything else on this story, gentlemen?
I'm all set.
I'm good.
All right, in that case, I'll wrap it up. That concludes this podcast of Technically Legal. Thank you for listening. I'm Dominic Robbie, and with me today were
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
Please visit our website at technicallylegal.org. Follow us on Twitter at @techlegal. If you have comments, thoughts, suggestions, ideas, please email us at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Thanks for listening.